Our veteran section today will come later in the show. We're going to talk about PTSD.
I don't have PTSD. I've heard that before.
There's a group of veterans doing a great thing. I want you all to listen, so stay tuned. Later in the show, in the second segment, we're going to talk about it. We're going to listen to them. But first, you really need to listen to this. In 1978, a star was born. Which star, you ask? Project Stargate. That was the code name for a secret U.S. Army unit established in 1978 in a small wooden barracks in Fort Meade, Maryland, run by the Defense Intelligence Agency of all people. In charge of it? Major General Albert Stubblebine. There were several sister projects being run at the same time as Stargate and preceding Stargate. Those programs, Gondola Wish, Grill Flame, Center Lane, Sunstreak, and Skinate, all operated until 1991 when they were consolidated and rechristened as the Stargate Project. Stargate Project worked primarily in the remote viewing arena. The project was terminated in 1995 when the CIA reported that the project had no significant use in intelligence operations. But documents reflect a very different story. Documents released just this year in 2017 in the CIA archives reflect a completely different story, a story of intrigue. And let me explain to you why. The power of these remote viewers is amazing. You can't believe, unless you've seen it with your own eyes, what they can do and what they have morphed into today. And I'm serious. They have morphed. 2 weeks ago, I talked a little bit about MKUltra, the remote viewing, and an operation called Operation Sandman. The Sandmen are nothing more than remote viewers. The remote viewers are given targets. They search those targets, they find those targets, and through their power of suggestion, they take those targets and cause them to die. What, you say? What do you mean they cause them to die? The remote viewers are able to mold the thinking patterns of their target into the target committing suicide. It was that simple. They're given coordinates, the target is found, and the remote viewer goes to work. It's something out of science fiction, I know. Thus the name Stargate. We see in the TV series, Stargate, where there's travel back and forth. We're going to talk about time travel. We're going to talk about the Stargate Project. We're going to talk about the CIA documents released that tell a completely different story as opposed to the official story. We talked about the MKUltra program and how it ended and two quietly began. MKUltra 2, that was simply referred to as 2. And the mind control portion of MKUltra moved in and morphed into a remote viewing aspect and a remote viewing control aspect. The MKUltra project itself, you've heard a lot out there, a lot about the MKUltra, about the mind control. There were over 40,000 people involved, mostly involuntarily and not knowing, in the MKUltra project, the initial MKUltra 1. They consisted of children, male and female, teenagers, young adults, adults and senior citizens, military personnel, federal prisoners. The spectrum was huge in the MKUltra program, and primarily, although they don't admit to it, drugs were used with these people to achieve the controlling aspect of what they were asked to do under mind control. that morphed into something a little different. That morphed into, they were able to discern that there were some with greater talents than others. And those with the greater talents were moved over in what was called 2, MK Ultra 2. And MK Ultra 2 was primarily concerned in remote viewing, the ability to see in the distance and sometimes in the future. That's a task that was unknown at the time. But these remote viewers could physically control other human beings. And as their talents developed, they found that not only could they control other human beings, they can control objects. They could control signals. And so that's what we're going to get into today. We're going to get into what's called electronic perturbation. Originally, they were looking at the ability of a remote viewer or a human subject to actually perturb an electronic signal, just interfere with the electronic signal. But as time progressed and as abilities progressed, they saw even more. They saw that these subjects were actually able to interact by mental means alone with sensitive electronic equipment. And so the project moved forward. They were trying to ascertain how this phenomena might be used as a weapon. That's right. Let me read you some of this. In this report, we consider the possible production of individuals of physical effects, such as perturbation of sensitive electronic equipment that appears to be well shielded against or otherwise inaccessible to human influence. Look at that. They're talking about human beings being able to integrate with a signal and influence that signal. Electronic signal. That is shielded. A shielded electronic signal. The precedent for considering whether sensitive electronic equipment can be influenced as a result of a remote perturbation phenomena has been established. CIA report. Secret. This ought to be beyond secret. This ought to be beyond top secret. The source of true random electronic output was established. How could this possibly be used as a weapon? Well, let's look at it. Going back a little bit, we have to understand how these remote viewers were actually trained. Sometimes they were given coordinates, map coordinates. As time progressed and we got GPS on board, they were trained in GPS coordinates and reading GPS coordinates, understanding where these coordinates would fall on the map. So a target could be as simple as looking at a GPS coordinate, looking at a map coordinate, and the remote viewer would explain to the controller what is being seen in that zone. Let's give you an example. Okay, I'm going to give coordinates of an island in the South Pacific and an airport on that island. And I want that remote viewer to look at that island, to look at that airport. What do you see there? Well, I see a lot of airplanes. Let's pick out an airplane. Which airplane do you want to pick out? Well, let's pick out an Air Asia airplane. Maybe one that's getting ready to taxi. Okay, let's take that. Let's take that aircraft ready to taxi. Now, follow that aircraft. Can you see that aircraft? Tell me about that aircraft. And the remote viewer would tell him about the aircraft. The remote viewer would tell him about what's going on inside the aircraft, what the pilot and co-pilot are currently doing, what the remote viewer hears, actually hearing the electronic signals from air traffic control, the voices, hearing people talk. That remote viewer can actually zoom in on people inside the aircraft and hear their conversations. Crazy, isn't it? You think it really happened that way? I guarantee it really happens that way. Not happened. They may have said that Stargate is no longer functional, and it probably isn't, as Stargate has a new name now. I don't know what that is, but I guarantee if they progress that far from the 40s, mid-40s, when MK Ultra and when Paperclip was first begun, all the way to the end of Stargate, I guarantee you there's more progression today in the human mind. Look how much of the human mind we use, 10%, and those remote viewers use a bit more. So here we are. We're following that aircraft. The controller says, can you take control of that aircraft? The remote viewer says, what do you mean take control? I don't know how to fly. Well, can you turn off communications? Where are communications? The remote and the controller will tell him, see that switch down there between the two pilots? Switch that radio off. They switch that radio off. Off goes the transponder. What more can he do? You know, aircraft today are fly-by-wire. What does that mean? Does that mean that a cable actually goes from the cockpit control facility back to the control entities? No, it means it's an electronic signal being sent. So if one can interfere with an electronic signal, one can actually take control of flight controls from a distance. Are there possible tests that have been done with that in the past? Maybe, a couple years ago, huh? Maybe an aircraft was flown without the control of the pilots. Maybe oxygen was turned off to that aircraft so that everyone on board at 37,000 feet died within 3 minutes without oxygen. And perhaps that remote viewer could control that aircraft, not really knowing where it's going because they're not a navigational expert, but just controlling it until it runs out of gas and falls out of the sky. Maybe that could happen. Just maybe that did happen. I don't know. I can't say. But I can say that by using this document and talking about the abilities of these remote viewers, but they're more than remote viewers. What could they be called today? Remote controls? Who knows? Wouldn't you love to get your hands on up-to-date documents from these guys? And here's a tagline for you. In the CIA report of their success is what they have to say. Considering the current ability of our own remote viewers to penetrate secure facilities, we feel that it is important to develop such a detector system. They're talking about systems that will detect RV intrusion, RP intrusion, the perturbation and viewing systems. Pretty telling, isn't it? We can see the application of this. I mean, we have probably seen it being used, just haven't realized it. You know, we can go back to events of the past where certain things have happened and the person who perpetrated these events had no history of this type of activity. You can look at someone who shot the President of the United States. Didn't recall having done such a thing, but he did it. We can look at someone who killed the Prime Minister of Israel. Student didn't recall doing it, but he did it. Can they claim insanity? Perhaps with these documents, they can claim control, mind control, manipulation by the CIA, by the Defense Intelligence Agency, or by the U.S. federal government. But here again, the United States isn't the only country that has these abilities. The MK Ultra program was instituted because of information that the Soviet Union and other and China already had these programs in place. So we have an all new battlefront, don't we? With these talented, gifted war machines sitting around the world. Something we need to take care of, or be careful of. Something we need to be aware of, more than anything. And perhaps, just perhaps, you may have been around someone, or may have been an unintentional target of one of these war machines. If you heard ringing in your ears, a sensation of ringing, buzzing, hissing, chirping, whistling, other sounds, can be intermittent, can sound like in beat and sync with your heart pulsating. Many times doctors will call it tinnitus. But sometimes, just sometimes, it could be something else. We'll be right back after this with more on the Recon Report. I'm Chip Tatum. Thanks for hanging in there, folks. This is Chip Tatum. We're back. This is the Recon Report on September 6, 2017. Wow. Can you imagine? Imagine that. 2017. Wow. 2017. I'm getting old. I've been around too long. I've seen too many wars. I've seen too many conflicts. I've seen too many operations. Black operations. And so have thousands of our fellow Americans. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Coping with what we've seen. Coping with what each of us have experienced, which is different. And we all perceive it as different. And we all categorize that differently in our own minds, and we all react to it differently. So how can one person, one counselor, really help you if there is help? Look, we come back from these wars, from operations overseas, around the world, and no one really understands. You just can't get a grasp of what we've seen and what we've been through. There's no way. I mean, I have people compare, yeah, I got in a fight with a bully. Come on. You have no idea. You have no idea what we experience. And that's why our veterans need help. Our veterans need attention. The suicide rate is astronomical. Why? Because we're being ignored. We're being thrown out to slaughter, mentally slaughter, physically slaughter, and to slaughter others. And we do a damn good job at it, I might say. But getting back on track here, when we return from combat zones, from special operations, what is there here for us? Active duty personnel, I mean, they have no real counseling to speak of unless they have overt symptoms. And then you don't want to present the overt symptoms because you'll get booted out of the service. So what do you do? For veterans, there is hope. There's an organization out there that can help, and I want to introduce you to that organization and their success rate. And it's veterans, helping veterans. That's what we're talking about. You know, we have a couple websites, VATVA.org, Veterans Against the VA.org. As we know, the VA has been amiss in their responsibilities. They just don't do what they get paid for, these federal government employees just don't give a damn. And I hope the president can change that. I hope the president has the wherewithal to go after these people who feel so comfortable in their positions that they don't think that they need to do their job. Well, enough of the rant. We also have RedRockWarriors.com. Those two websites are there. There's information there for you veterans and for everyone. Veterans, families, supporters. Anyone can go there. Anyone can see what we're offering. And please do so. The Red Rock Warriors is still being filled with content for you. So be patient with that. But it's going to be probably one of the premier websites, one of the premier information centers on the internet. We're hoping to get anything and everything that you need in one-stop shopping right there, from education benefits to personal family help to clinical help, even monetary help. We know that it's tough out there, and we're here to help you. So with that being said, let's look at the PTSD issue. Let's listen to this. It's coming up right now.
Central Intelligence Agency.
It was described by witnesses as...
I was in denial of how bad it really was. The outer shell of him came back. But everything on the inside was dead. It's like it just died in Iraq.
Every day, at least 22 U.S. veterans commit suicide. That's almost 8,000 a year. But a new program could save their lives. It's called Save a Warrior.
This isn't broken. This is broken. And that's why you're in that chair, I assert.
He's told me multiple times that if this program doesn't work, he's going to kill himself. So, I am literally on borrowed time right now.
How's the family situation when your booze and pills kick in? I see some heads nodding up and down. It's not working for you, is it?
It was only a 5-day program.
How can a person change in 5.5 days?
13 soldiers.
The Brotherhood has a lot to do with it.
And the stakes, everything.
And this is the last house on the block.
I feel guilty because I have so much.
I feel like I'm back in a parachute. I got hurt in a parachute.
They literally feel in that moment they're gonna die.
How are you feeling?
I love you, brother.
I'm learning how to love you guys back.
How many men have you had come through this?
100 active duty and returning warriors.
How many would you guess were suicidal?
Somewhere between 80 and 90.
And how many have killed themselves?
None.
I got a lot riding on this. Yeah, my life is riding on it.
A startling number to hear 8,000 veterans killing themselves on a yearly basis. Joining me now is Jake Clark, the founder of Save a Warrior, the program that you just saw featured in that report. Jake, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So you yourself are a veteran, two times, first enlisted and as an officer. You've also served as an LAPD officer and as a FBI agent, Secret Service. Correct?
That's correct.
So you have a long history of active duty and service to your country, and yet here you have started an organization in 2012, I believe, that is basically showing the consequences, the next step beyond what people see as the heroic troop going off to fight the war, the macho bravado of American militarism. What brought you to that point of saying, look, we need to do something to actually help these guys cope with the consequence of what they're facing?
You know,
It was many things, Sean. I was watching the numbers of these young, particularly young male warriors. 98% of the PTS-related suicide are male warriors. And I was frustrated that someone could survive in environments like Iraq and Afghanistan and come home and not survive the relative peace of the reintegration. And as I began to look more at the issue, I found that historically, this had been an issue going back as early as the Civil War, but more in a more contemporary way. What my big fear was is that it was similar to the disintegration of the returning Vietnam warrior, where many will tell you I was spit on and called a baby killer. That slogan or that euphemism was replaced with thank you for your service and hey, good luck with that PTS. So our guys interpret that as, hey, better you than me. And there really wasn't, I don't think the public had a real listening for it because so few relative in a scale have served. When you look at numbers in World War II and you look at numbers in Vietnam, for example, 11% of the public served during World War II, 4% in Vietnam. And in this contemporary conflict era, it's 0.045. So less than one half of 1% of Americans have put boots on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan. So they're not really tuned into not so much the issue of war, but what it's like for someone to try to come home from multiple deployments and blast injuries and losing friends and trying to find where's my fit now that I've come back and I've served. That you know, and the downward spiral that comes with that, the drinking, the medication, the contact with law enforcement, the not being able to hold a job, the disintegration of their families, the downward spiral seemed much quicker than what happened with the returning Vietnam warrior. And I thought, you know, I need to do something about this because I've been very blessed from my military experience that led to all those great careers that I had that I wanted to do. And I was given amazing educational benefits from having served in the military. You know, being a kid from a small town in Amish country in Lancaster County, those opportunities were not going to come to me any other way that I could think of. And I felt this need to give back, but it was more a sense of frustration, like this is just not okay. There was a social injustice that I felt that a young 22, 23, 24-year-old warrior would find that with all of the systems in place, their thinking ultimately led them to taking their own life. Right. I just struggled being with that.
And I mean, that is the 8,000 number we're looking at is not just young veterans, it's also older veterans too that are continuing to kill themselves, right? Guys from the Vietnam era.
Correct.
Right.
That number is a little tricky. It doesn't get broken down typically in when it's spoken about, but the vast majority, the preponderance of that number are the Vietnam era veterans who've just said, you know what, I've had enough. I've been trying to heal for 45 going on 50 years. It's just not going to work out for me. I just can't find a foothold in my healing. And I think the numbers that don't get counted, the suicides by cop, the accidental overdoses, the alcohol poisonings, the driving a car across six lanes of traffic, the anything to preserve the equivocal nature of that death so that maybe insurance benefits can be paid or a person doesn't want to leave a legacy of suicide for their children to have to confront. So the number's very tricky. It is very, very tricky. But what we do know because of social media and because of the immediacy of communication between warriors that have come back, you know, through things like Facebook and Twitter and just instant messaging, is they know immediately when a buddy has taken their own life. One of the subjects of the documentary mentions in the film that he's had 10 buddies kill themselves out of his battalion. And that's a staggering number. You're looking at, over time, holocaustal numbers of warriors coming back where the IAVA, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans Association, released a study last week where 800,000 or one in three returning warriors from Iraq and Afghanistan have considered or are considering suicide. 800,000, that's a big number. Even if only 10% were to ultimately take their lives, you know, that's more warriors that were lost in the Vietnam War. But I think it's going to go much higher than that because the warrior becomes frustrated so quickly that they can't find relief any other way
right.
than to take their own life.
Well, it's interesting because Chris Kyle was in the news even though he's passed away. And he was in the news this week because Jesse Ventura was suing him over allegations in his Chris Kyle's book, you know, American Sniper, that he had knocked Jesse out in a bar. And Jesse won the case where he said this was libelous and it was not true. He won the case, but Kyle himself was killed by a buddy, according to the news reports, right, a buddy who had PTSD, right, he was trying to help him by taking to him gun range, right?
Correct.
Do you think that was the right strategy to help?
I would say that Chris Kyle, who in his military career and in his passing is looked by that community as a national treasure and someone that was really trying to take his celebrity and you know, transition that into benevolence and paying it forward. And tragically, you know, he took a young warrior at his word that he was looking for support. And what that young warrior wanted was Chris's vehicle. He wanted to steal the truck. And, you know, his thinking was so psychotic at that point, he thought, well, if I just kill him and I kill Chris's friend, I'm going to go outside, because he immediately confessed to his sibling, you know, I think I killed these two guys. I wanted the truck. And it just shows you that when someone has a psychotic break, that the tragedy can happen even to someone like a Chris Kyle, whose heart was in the right place. But, you know, me personally, in our programs, I would never introduce anything like that, because I don't think you need to revisit anything traumatic to heal trauma. But, you know, this was a very skilled operator, highly decorated, the best at what he did. It was just a series of unfortunate events where he ran across somebody who was looking to have, you know, who was going to find those kind of circumstances.
Right.
And it's just terribly, terribly unfortunate. And even the aftermath of everything that happened, it's very sad all the way around.
But it's interesting how the cycle of aggression is not just into suicide, but also towards killings like this, right, of a soldier who's come back who's suffering with PTSD and ends up shooting a fellow soldier. I mean, this right. is not an isolated case. This is also occurring.
Correct.
Right? The cycle of aggression and violence.
What we seek to do is to put warriors in a very controlled set and setting with a high degree of intention, with a dosing and a sequence where they're on a parallel path with other warriors that have gone through a healing process with us, so that they're met with what we refer to as unconditional positive regard. No judgment, no criticism, nothing as ad hoc as maybe taking a guy to a gun range that seems benign on its face because they're two warriors, but it's very deliberate and very well thought out and very crafted. It's almost like an ARG or like an alternate reality game where it's very player intensive, and there's a suspension of disbelief and a willingness to lean into the unknown, because our guys are in so much pain when they come to us that they're desperate enough to take direction and maybe do something alternative that, you know, 100, 200, 300 years ago would have been pro forma. You know, for example, a Native American coming back to a reservation would have undergone sweat lodges and healing ceremonies and things that were steeped in ritual and ceremony and spiritual initiation. So there's kind of a missing leg on that hero's journey of separation, initiation, and return with treasure. You know, you have guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and now with skirmishes, you know, ramping back up, asking themselves, you know, what is it that I fought for? Why did I lose my friends there? So there's a big open wound. And when I point to in the opening, you know, this isn't broken, this is broken. We deal with guys primarily and women whose hearts are broken because of what happened before they joined the military, maybe some circumstances that happened during their career. And we seek to create space where there is no space so that they can move through these events very quickly and process this trauma and get on with their lives.
Well, you mentioned the Native American process, and I think that, you know, what you're referring to is a spiritual journey mm-hmm. that is not really accepted by most of the mainstream thinking about the military. And when I say I'm opposed to the support our troops sloganeering, is that, you know, it's like no matter where we are in the world, we have, you know, we have our guys everywhere. The military has a presence in over 100 countries in the world, and we have to support that no matter what. And yet we're throwing kids into battlefields they don't understand, right? We're putting them in positions to be killers, to see horrible things unfold, and not even understanding what's the connection to protecting their family, protecting their homes, right? We've kind of had this disconnect in our probably since Vietnam, of actually fighting for something with stakes, where you're, you know, as opposed to just having troops present in foreign countries, having an occupation kind of mentality. And I think that that does, obviously, like you said, it can leave a spiritual gap where people are wondering, what am I fighting for? What am I doing here? How is this really helping America? This is not a special ops assassination of an Al-Qaeda leader. This is us, you know, having a presence in Afghanistan to make sure the Taliban don't get back in power. But at the end of the day, you know, it's not our country, and they look at us as invaders. How can we help And I say, I think what you're doing is ultimately helping to change the overall system of how we approach what it is to be a warrior, which is to say, you know, it's not to be a killer, it's not to be someone who just blindly follows orders, but always has a spiritual grounding and a purpose in what they're trying to serve.
A lot of things are surfacing in the aftermath of, okay, how do we get to a place where there's 22 suicides a day in the count? How do we get to a place where there's phantom lists of people being served at the VA? How do we get to a place where we've put so much resource into a system of socialized medicine that continuously falls short? How do we get to a place where we don't learn the lessons of history? Why do we keep revisiting the maxim of history teaches us we learn nothing from history? Why aren't we learning? Why aren't we learning? And what I endeavored to do in this was, number one, not ask for anybody's permission, to be incredibly disruptive, catalytic, a bit startling with this approach, and look at what the mainstream offering was, and look at some things a little more anthropologically or a little more holistically or metaphysically. And the good news is that the neuroscience, the science, everybody wants to go, the science is catching up with metaphysics. And what they're finding is we're at a place in time where the population, for the first time in recorded history, doesn't believe in a spiteful and punishing supreme deity. They believe in one that's more loving and kind and generous and benevolent. So there's a listening in these warriors to seek an experience that rises to the mystic. And we have found through science, through neuroscientific evidence out of the University of Pennsylvania, that we can create the ideal condition for that moment to occur for them to disrupt and dislodge this vector-assigned path towards suicide and have them consider another way to go and express to them in a way that is devoid of politics, that is devoid of partisan bickering, that, listen, we want to craft you into a servant leader. We believe that if we teach you at a very spiritual level, agnostic, be it atheist, agnostic, secular, whatever your belief system is, we want to present you with something that complements that belief or non-belief in a supreme deity that allows you to travel through these experiences that you're going to have in some extraordinary circumstances and still come out the other side and be able to live your life on life's terms and not melt down and not reach for the booze, the drugs, the shopping, the porn, the whatever the distraction is.
Which everyone does. Yeah, I mean,
but the warrior caste, right? But the warrior caste doesn't want to be seen that way. You talk about, you know, there is a growing sense of nationalism and the flyovers and the flags and we support the troops and here's the bumper sticker. And then I point to the statistic and I go, yeah, but, you know, and that we're still racking up this epidemic number of returning warrior suicides, and right. And people don't know what to do. People want to help, but they don't know what to do. So I said to myself, let me take all of these things I've been looking at for 30 years. You know, it all begins with, I have an idea. And the timing for me was such that I was in an MBA program and came across some literature from a Harvard Business School professor who talked about the business modeling and the cost efficiencies, because people are always going to ask, Sean, what does it cost? What does it cost? And it's typically less than the cost of a month's prescription medication that is only masking the issue anyway. So I really try to apply some well-grounded, common sense thinking to an otherwise esoteric area that we're venturing into, and knock some of, you know, the crunchiness off of it and present it in a way that a Delta Commando, a Green Beret, an active duty Marine, a Scout Sniper, a PJ from the Air Force, an Army Ranger would come in and after 5.5 days say, validate it and go, that worked. That is exactly what I required to take the next step and to begin the next, you know, part of my healing journey. And that's what I think, that's why the lightning has struck in Malibu and now that thunderclap is being heard around the country in this film. Really brings it into stark relief where we're saying, listen, there is a solution. We need support. Please be thoughtful in your giving and your donations of where you're putting your support. Giving this guy a t-shirt and an outing to Dodger Stadium is not going to help in any way with his PTS. You're going to distract from the distraction. But if we really want to be serious, it's going to take a community resiliency model that has the history of other community resiliency models that have shown that they work. And we're very excited at this point. You know, we've never lost a warrior to suicide, and most guys coming to me are prior attempts. They've tried to take their own lives. They've tried to hang themselves. They've been up on the bridge. They've swallowed the pills. I've had a guy fire a gun off next to his head. I've had warriors sitting in parks in Cincinnati with 45 pistols pressed to their forehead, moments away from pulling the trigger, 3 days later in a 60-foot round pen with a wild Mustang, getting back down in their bodies, getting back down in reality. And to the outside people, they can be thinking, it can't be that simple. It actually is that simple. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take 5.5 days. It takes that moment in time to create that breakthrough for that warrior. And I think the film shows that very nicely.
So where will the documentary you're referring to, the film, where will that be seen or
that
screened?
That will be seen on August 12th on CNN at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 9 p.m. Pacific Time as well. And then it airs again on the 17th of August on CNN.
Awesome. And that's going to show more of the techniques. But tell us a little bit about what were the basic techniques you were trying to implement, let's say, what is the core philosophy or essence?
You know, a lot of experiential therapy and psychoeducation in a way to express to the warrior what's really going on with them physiologically. So we express to them, explain to them in very minute detail what's happening physiologically inside their brain. And so that they understand, you know, what's going on upstairs. But we go in through their heart. We really try to move them about 12 inches south and really try to touch them in an emotional, moving way. And it seems to take care of what's going on upstairs. Now, meditation is a time-tested skill with a lot of science and evidence to back that up, that it can re-regulate the limbic system of the brain that is hyperactive and is causing a lot of fear-based behavior and a lot of poor decision-making. And when our warriors get into their meditation practice, very quickly higher order thinking and executive order thinking in the brain begins to take over. There's a sense of a growing sense of ease and comfort and the ability to make rational and solid decisions. The other things that we do with equine and high ropes are trust building and community building and lead toward goal setting, behavior typing, because it's really the peer-to-peer support that they take away from the project. And you know, one of the things we say to them, we can't save them all, but we can help them all save themselves, because it is this generation of returning warriors, given the proper tools and skills, they can save themselves, because they're natural servant leaders. It is in their DNA to pay it forward. As an example, every time to a warrior that I enroll them in the project, they stop at some point and say, I don't want to take the seat away from somebody who really deserves it. And they want to give their seat up to a buddy who may also be suffering. And our response is, look, let's get a good seal on your oxygen mask, and then you can pay it forward, but it's your turn. Take your turn. You know, this is a very benevolent cast of people in our society that have a lot to contribute and pay forward. And sometimes they get lumped into a protected class that I don't think it is deserved, as we would say with the homeless or single mothers or prisoners. And we want to lump them into a disadvantaged group of people. These are very, very, when you send somebody to war 5, 6, 7, 8 times, that's a very resilient group of people that have something to contribute and have life's lessons to pass on to the next generation. So maybe we don't go wandering into another quagmire like this so quickly.
Well, I think that there is something to be said for this whole, the archetype of the old man and the wise elders, let's call it. Mm-hmm. And we've kind of lost that, it feels, in our society. We don't give that respect. There are a few figures like that who are wise older people. We don't really give them that respect. It's a very much a youth-oriented culture. And I think that people like yourself are trying to work towards that archetype of, like, let's foster these people so that they can ultimately take on leadership positions and become the wise elders because of their experience and having actually grown from it, as opposed to where a lot of people fail, is that they go and they have the experience of war, but they don't really synthesize how to, like you said, pay it forward. How do you actually learn from it and grow as a person? You know, I think my father sent him up for that reason, because he was, he's a veteran who tried to utilize his experience and turn it towards art, right, and put a lot of his anger and emotion. I think art probably saved him a lot of the trauma that many people don't know where to put it into. And so with films like Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, I think that was him basically saying, look, this is my way of paying it forward to people, to either warn them, caution them against war, but also to show what we really face. That it's not a glorification of war, which we see too often, unfortunately, in the cinema.
Well, you know, I'm glad you mentioned your father, because I was a young 20-year-old soldier in Boston when that film debuted, and I remember who I went to the movie with, I remember the time of the year, and I remember how struck I was by the timelessness of that warrior's journey that is a, an adaptation that I understand of your father's experience in war. And as that warrior, he goes into the realm of a warrior sage, as would a Carl Marlantis, who's another Vietnam warrior. And both of these men were very fortunate, highly educated, very polished, tip of the spear, fighting experience, in the middle of all of this experience, and have the, for lack of a better term, decency and mindset to not be discouraged, because I know what it took Carl to get his book published that ended up informing our work in Ceremony, Ritual, and Spiritual Initiation, the book, What It Is Like to Go to War. And I can only imagine what your father went through when he was trying to put that deal together to get that movie made, and then Born on the 4th of July. But there's a knowing, there's an almost an internal knowing that there's someone out there who's going to hopefully listen and pay attention. But just for myself personally, we've taken Vietnam warriors through the project, and they've been incredibly emotional in saying, I waited 45 years for this. And that is the social injustice, just, the world according to Jay Clark for a second. But that is what really bothers me, because it's so cost effective when I think of all of the resource that's been expended turning these young warriors into veterans, and so little on the back end with something so effective. But it is the art that saves us. We use a lot of cultural art form in our work. The term we use is we unpack certain films for their content and for the lessons that are available for family of origin trauma, for living a life, for finding a strategy for a life worth living. But you could use a film like Platoon at Save a Warrior. You could use Born on the 4th of July, and our guys can relate to those experiences, because again, the journey is timeless of the warrior. The journey of going into battle and being in that Temple of Mars. But that's not where the trauma really occurs. That is where the warrior becomes fully fledged in surviving in the Temple of Mars. But it's the coming back and revisiting the things that didn't get worked out, maybe from childhood, maybe from adolescence, and not feeling complete. So we want to feel complete. And I think when your father is doing a film like Platoon, there is a sense of completion for him spiritually. And then he moves on to, okay, I told what it's like in theater. Let me talk about the disintegration of a Ron Kovic and what it's like coming home. And someone like me watches that as a student of his work. And for me, that's his lecture. And what do I take away, and how do I pay it forward so that I'm not constantly in my head thinking about the things that, darken my own world. Yeah. So they're passing the torch. And thank God for warriors like that who didn't go out, what the problem is today is the generals coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan pimp themselves out for $400 an hour as a mentor, but they don't come out to Malibu and say, hey, I like what you're doing. You're saving the mess, and you're cleaning up the mess that I've created. Right. Great job. What do you need? No, right. they're on TV shows, and they're talking about the solution, and they're selling their books, and they're getting in the Carlisle Group and sitting on boards. And I'm over here in Malibu with a choice few words for these guys, because as someone who's been with these warriors but is a little bit longer in the tooth and who's been in some, combat theaters and in the former Yugoslavia, I understand the cost of what can happen. And I let that anger and frustration drive me into that next, young warrior who's still in his 20s and doesn't deserve to die like that. So I see that of what happens with our leaders when they come home that don't get involved. To me, that's a war crime. That's a war crime that
more so when they're profiting from
it. When they're profiting from it.
Which is really what this military-industrial complex really means. And I think that's why it's such an offense. I mean, my father's been a big critic of the military-industrial complex. And, with films like JFK, stoked, that phrase again, people started using it as a result. Because, like you're saying, these generals, these politicians, they're making money from the missiles and from the, from blowing up countries. And then also then reconstruction, whatever, the cost of reconstruction. They're profiting from it. But the grunts, they're not making anything out of it. They go, they serve, they get discarded. They have no back end interest.
Well, they have no stake in the outcome. But yeah. What people don't understand about the young warriors that I got to serve with whom I'm a generation older, is each one of them has a Marshall Plan inside of them. They want to build something. They want to leave something behind. And as a young kid growing up in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, my coaches were all Vietnam warriors. And I could see this. There was this pall of sadness that they carried. But in going back 30, 35 years, 40 years later and asking them, did you know intuitively that this would save you? And they said, on some level, I knew that I had to not isolate and be out in the community. And thank God, to be able to look back and say, hey Rudy, hey Mike, hey Barry, I was paying attention. Like your suffering was not lost on me. And you know, growing up in a family where there was mental illness and going to mental institutions again and again and again to visit a mother who wasn't getting better, I thought, you know, we're missing something, and it can't be this difficult. We can't just be sticking people in VAs and medicating these guys and tying them down and stigmatizing them. And you know, I mentioned the young warrior in Cincinnati. You know, he was begging the police officer. He says, "I promise, I won't kill myself as long as you don't take me to the VA. Just don't take me to the VA." And you know, our leaders need to hear that. And I think when you have someone like, we were very fortunate in one regard to have a Secretary of Defense like a Robert Gates. But you know what, Mr. Gates, why don't you put your name in the hat to be the Secretary of the VA and clean that mess up? Or why not go out to someone like Bill Gates, who's shown that he can take positive outcomes to other places in the world, where he's doing it from a place of benevolence and not a place of what's on his business card or where the station is going to take him or leave him. But you need to put somebody in charge of a system like that who really cares about people, who's not interested in creating shareholder value and managing quarterly earnings reports. You know, they're going to bring in a new secretary. I understand he's got a West Point and military background. But you had Eric Shinseki in there as the secretary, who is a phenomenal world-class warrior like no other. And if a man like that cannot go into that system and transform it, then thoughtful leaders need to look and say, why couldn't Eric transform that? He's the best of the best. There is no better. What was it that allowed those failures to occur under the watch of such a fully fledged, highly regarded, well-respected warrior by the rank and file? So rather than continue to throw good money after bad where there's no bottom on the bucket, I think that our government and our institutional thought leaders need to start looking at templates like this and go, I wonder why that's working. What are they doing there? And it comes down to innovators that don't look for permission to do the next right thing and have to go through layers and layers of bureaucracy to do what it is that they think is the right thing to do for the people that are most deserving in our society. And when I say most deserving, I work with warriors every day who, the minute they finish this program, want to go out and pay it forward to someone else for fun and for free. You know, that's rare in this society, because we're all, you know, what's in it for me?
Right.
And that's why I enjoy what I do. So I don't know if I somehow answered where we were trying to go with this, but, you know, Rome is burning.
Rome is burning. Do you think your system could be applied also to, like, prisoners, for example?
I believe that it can, and I believe that it there are programs. We worked very closely for a long time with David Lynch Foundation, who has a prisoner program. And what you find is, it's hard for me to wrap my mind around somebody sitting inside of a building behind bars and letting human potential go to waste like that, because I believe, I'm a big believer in the restorative justice process. I think that healing can occur on both sides. You know, if we go, you know, the old saying, if it's an eye for an eye, eventually, you know, you got a country full of blind people. And that's just, again, I have my own.
The most punitive system most in the world. We have so many men under bar, at least 2 million people.
We're approaching 3 million.
Wow.
You know, we're the most punitive society on the planet. And we take, you know, all this human potential, and we don't seek to offer the opportunity for transformation. I saw a documentary recently where Mercy College was on an HBO documentary, and it was beautiful seeing people have the opportunity to have education, because how long will you punish somebody for what they did? And when we choose not to forgive people that have wronged us, it's like, you know, we're taking poison hoping that the other person dies. So we have to elevate the conversation, and we have to raise the consciousness of where we're going as a society, because eventually we will implode. Because America, for me, has always existed as an idea of what's possible. This country's been very good to me. And sometimes all you can do is work your own little square and try to make a difference where you are. And at the same time, when I did that, we designed this with the idea of scaling and replicability, not only for returning warriors, but for active duty warriors as well. And, you know, so far, so good. And I think, you know, I know that we're very fortunate to have someone like Soledad O'Brien, who spent so much time looking at our work and trying to understand why it was so effective. And now the active components are looking and saying, hey, is this something that would fit for us? And we're very excited about what's possible.
Absolutely. Are you planning on expanding it beyond? Right now you're based in Malibu, so would it ultimately expand to the other states?
I've done this work with our team back at an East Coast location in Virginia near the Beltway. There's been a few spin-off resiliency programs One that originated out of a documentary film called The Invisible War on military sexual trauma. We were consulted heavily on some of the ingredients, and they've evolved that into their own healing methodology. But yeah, this is something that our warriors will be able to take with some of the revisions we've made to the curriculum and immediately go back into their communities around the country, teach other warriors how to meditate, put them in relationship with people that can start standing up these kinds of opportunities around the country in a very, very cost-effective way. So it's about moving market share, creating new markets, and telling people through this film and a second film coming out about Save a Warrior at Sundance at the top of next year. But it's exciting to know that, you know, these young guys and girls don't need to die like this. They don't need to kill themselves. That there is a solution. You know, it's a very problem-centric conversation. Number, problem. And it's like, wait a second.
The solution is, how do we transform this? Let's not just
exactly
keeps repeating the fact of, oh, they're coming home and killing themselves. What are you doing about it? How do we
exactly? And I wanted to get in the business of doing, and I found some incredible. I've had a lot of great support from our providers and from outside organizations and from some places I really didn't expect it. So I'm excited about what the future holds for Save a Warrior and some of the associated programs that we're involved with.
How can people support your organization and also learn more, follow?
They could go on to saveawarrior.org, or they could go onto our Facebook page at Save a Warrior, and there's a great chronology there and photographs. And I think what would make an impression on people is how cost-effective we are. It looks like we spend millions and millions of dollars to the outside eye, but for example, in 2013, to arguably save 90 lives, we spent less than $150,000 total in Malibu, California.
Yeah.
You know, because there's a compression of healers out there because of all the high thread count recovery centers. It's the ideal set and setting to do this work on the West Coast. But they could go to saveawarrior.org, they could go to the Facebook page and really explore. And don't take me at my word. Don't believe anything I'm saying. Get a hold of us, come out and visit and see what we do. Talk to some of our alumni. See what we're all about, and I think this is a great place to make an investment if someone is really interested in supporting someone who's been willing to risk their lives. And I'm not going to sit here and be a parrot and say they risk their lives for us. They risk their lives for a cause greater than themselves, something that they believed in, something that they were indoctrinated into. They said, okay, I will participate. I will give of myself freely.
Right.
I believe we need stations like that in society because of what they're willing to do here at home.
Absolutely. If they are willing to take on that burden of leadership, or at least the responsibility, then if they're in a healthy position, they could ultimately become the future leaders of our country. And I think that's oftentimes the ones that I look to personally. I think I look to a lot of people from within the military, within, or structures like that, to step forward and tell their stories, to reveal the things that the official government, the official kind of bureaucracy doesn't want revealed, and the experiences, the stories, so that we can understand each other better as humans and what we're going through and this human experience. I think we need these guys. We need them alive.
I agree. I think there's something so wrong. There's a 10-tour Green Beret in this documentary. Bobby Farmer, it can only be characterized as a national treasure. And when you understand his story and what he's given and what he's lost and what he stands for and what he's about, they should be throwing resource at a guy like Bobby Farmer to have his own conversation of healing, whether he chooses it to do in his home city, down south. But that is someone that the government needs to be seeking out, in a very urgent way, because he is such an intuitive healer, and he's gone through his own healing process and leaned into it, and he has so much to give away. But that is someone himself who could be responsible for saving thousands of lives, versus a young doctor in the VA trying to pay off student loans, writing out scripts for more and more psychotropics, patting that warrior in the back, hey, good luck with that. You have these people like Bobby, you have people like Dusty Baxley, you have these warriors that have come home, that have been to war, that understand the consequence, that don't want to, get into, political dialogue and political argument, but they want to serve, and they've shown that they have this ability, having transmuted their own suffering, having transformed their own suffering into a cause greater than themselves. And these warriors crave these relationships with people like Bobby Farmer, with men like Dusty Baxley. And I hope that what they find here in Malibu as well, I get that they really get that we care, that they're important to us, that we celebrate their victories, that their families are important to us. And, We probably have 300 children in our community today that aren't orphans because of our work. And we're very proud and we're very humbled to be in a position to say that. But we could do more. If I had resource that was available, that other organizations have available to them, if some of that resource was moved in our direction, we could save a lot more lives. And I think we've proven that. Maybe I have to get over the 1,000 warrior threshold before someone really takes us seriously. Maybe Anderson Cooper needs to come do the project, and 25 million eyeballs need to see that on a Sunday night where they go, oh, that's interesting. Right. But that, it's working through having an opportunity to sit with someone like you who's having a thoughtful dialogue about it, who understands, having grown up with a father who's been through that experience, so you're able to frame a conversation in a way that's thoughtful and provoking. And you know, this really comes down to a national security issue, because if we don't save this generation of returning warriors, this country will never fully field an effective military or what is known as a power projection platform. And as much as we may not want to believe that, there's a reason that stock market moves in a certain direction. There's a reason electricity works in this country and water stays cut on. And there's a reason things work in this society. It's because of our ability to influence outcomes internally and externally in the world because of what we represent militarily and what we represent as an ideal. And anyone that doesn't agree with that is just not looking at this realistically and need look no further than the former Yugoslavia, where systems don't work and they're still trying to recover from genocidal atrocities that happened going on 20 years ago. So we are moving precipitously in that direction as a people.
Fielding too many mercenary armies.
Exactly.
At the expense of our own military.
Exactly, and we need to begin to get back to basics. Well-grounded, common sense approaches, I think, will serve us in the long run. And we're at a very interesting time and place where this generation is ready to do something very radical to save itself, which, you know, is perpendicular to what's being offered in traditional systems. And it's exciting to be a part of that, you know, to have that, to be in that conversation and to feel like you're living a life that you're meant to live.
Right.
And you're participating in preserving life rather than, you know, five different organizations taught me how to kill. The Army, the LAPD, the Secret Service, the FBI, and the California National Guard all taught me how to kill. Not one of those organizations ever spent 5 minutes trying to teach me how to live. And that's the missing in that conversation.
And that's what you're doing now, though.
That's what we're doing now, Sean.
Absolutely. Well, I think you're doing a great job.
Thank you.
I really support what you're doing.
I'm honored. I'm honored to do what I do. Thank you.
I can't wait to hit that 1,000 mark. And then obviously there'll be a long future for Save a Warrior because we need it.
Thank you. And we'd love to have you out to Malibu at some point to see what we do.
Absolutely.
Just up the road. So thank you, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks
so much.
Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Absolutely. So there you have it, folks. SaveAWarrior.org. Please follow them on Facebook and pay attention. Support however you can. What Jake is doing is tremendously important and valuable work, as you now understand. This is Sean Stone signing off.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Jake. You know, that interview was done in 2014, and today it's estimated between 20 to 22 veterans per day commit suicide. Between 20 and 22 per day. The war has come home, folks. The war has come home. And we need to do something here. The Help a Warrior Foundation is probably one way to do it. There are others out there. I encourage you, caregivers. I encourage you, family members. I encourage you, veterans. Veterans, take hold of yourselves, first of all. First of all, try to take hold of yourselves. I know that sometimes the pain's so great. I've been there. I know that. I know that sometimes you just feel that there's no other alternative. There's nothing you can do. You've lost your home. You've lost your family. You've lost your loved ones. You've lost your health. What do? You find a new home. You build a new family. You work toward your health. That's what you do. You just don't give up. Damn! Get on board. Family members. Caregivers. Veterans. Get on board and do something. Don't just wait for someone to do it for you.